on this episode of China Unscripted, why Chinese communism is winning, hacking China censorship, and when art exhibits get dangerous. Welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And once again, our humble little podcast is being sponsored by Path of Cha Tea. Today, we are drinking Lushan Yunwu Clouds and Mist Green Tea. Go ahead, guys. Take a taste of this.
Well, first, it smells amazing.
It smells really nice.
Yeah, the leaves themselves were pretty incredible and brewed even better. So, excuse me, I have to stop talking to drink. I'm not that talented. Ooh, that's real good green tea.
It's kind of roasty.
Wow, yeah. This is really good.
It's got a nice roastiness. Now, the trick, especially with this kind of green tea, is to brew it at a lower temperature. Otherwise, you can get kind of a bitter taste to the green tea, which is kind of what a lot of people associate green tea with, but that's usually because they just use straight boiling water. Like, this is about, I used about 175 degrees Fahrenheit.
This is why you need to get a Japanese water boiler, the kind that has, like, different temperature settings for the different teas.
It does help. Or you can just boil it to full blast and then pour it back and forth a few times. That's what I used to do, too. So the story behind this tea is it grows on the Lushan Mountains. And it was supposedly, this particular tea was supposedly planted by a famous Buddhist monk. So he sort of planted the seeds of tea and the seeds of Buddhism. So, yeah, it definitely has a very nice floral, chestnutty kind of aroma.
I just realized I don't know how tea plants grow.
Well, from the ground.
A mommy and a daddy tea plant love each other very much.
Okay.
Well, that actually is a good question. So, well, now we're veering off into tea topics. But since I know a thing or two about tea, some of the most prized tea in China actually comes from, like, these very old, like, hundreds-of-year-old tea trees that have just grown to such a large size because they were part of the tea production, like, 500 years ago. And eventually, like, it was sort of a state-backed industry for a while, like we're talking Imperial China, as used as, like, a trading commodity. But then when the government kind of shifted away to other things, some of these tea farms were abandoned, so you had these wild tea trees just left kind of growing out. But the modern horticulture for tea, it's much more, you know, they're usually smaller, they're more bush-like. They don't really have a chance to grow into, like, these kind of big trees.
I'm actually impressed that they lasted so long.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely tea trees in the world that are hundreds of years old. Maybe somewhere even thousands. So, oh my gosh, hold on, I'm still drinking tea.
Chris is getting distracted. But if you would like to experience Lushan Yunwu tea yourself,
well, we
go
have
to Path of Cha.
Pathofcha.com, and our link is at the bottom. So if you click the link in the description, it'll also support China Unscripted.
This is very good green tea. So if you don't know much about tea, I would recommend just trying this. It's the Lushan Yunwu Clouds and Mist Green Tea.
So in their brewing instructions, they have a Western method and something called Gongfu.
Yeah, so, I mean, traditionally, if you're doing, like, Chinese Gongfu tea ceremony, that's where you would use something like a gaiwan, like a small little tea bowl that you put, like, a bunch of leaves in and, like, fill it up. Like, it's almost completely filled up with leaves. You pour some water in there, and then, like, instantly pour it out into little tiny teacups.
Mm.
And you go through multiple brewings, like, usually, like, 5 to 6, to sort of experience the full range of flavors for the tea. Like, each brew has a successive, it changes in taste and aroma. The Western brewing method, just kind of, like, put a bunch in a big cup and pot and brew for, like, 3 minutes. You're done.
I see. Taking the easy way out.
It's taking the easy way out.
I like the Western method. I think that sounds great.
That is kind of what I did for this, since doing the Gongfu style for a podcast would be difficult. Even this is difficult because I want to drink. So, while I'm enjoying this, Shelley, lead us away with our top story.
Well, actually,
and remember to check out Path of Cha.
Yes. So, I wanted to propose a segment for our podcast called, you know, Wu Mao of the Week, where we highlighted different I mean, I don't know if we should be giving them attention, but pro-Chinese Communist Party people who come and troll our videos or, you know, the internet in general. And we've noticed, like, a 500% increase in these people.
With Hong Kong.
After we started covering the Hong Kong protests. Like, I think there's a definitely, well, I mean, there's definitely a concerted effort to have these types of defending China, quote-unquote, posts all over the internet, not just on our YouTube videos.
I mean, since Hong Kong is part of China, to defend Hong Kong is to defend China.
Ooh.
Mm.
Tea has granted you wisdom.
The Zen cone of... anyway.
So what is this comment say?
Okay, so this is probably my favorite so far of the new Wu Mao comments. Wu Mao for 50 centers, right? It says, China Uncensored, F you. Why are we Chinese so rich now? We own all the most expensive residential properties in English-speaking and Western countries. We're the biggest spending tourists in the world. We're the top European brands like LV, Gucci, etc., number one customers. Our children are the smartest in most Western schools and universities. So how can you say Chinese communism is broken?
Hmm.
That is quite a conundrum. How can we say that Chinese communism is broken if a small, small percentage of Chinese people are really, really rich, guys?
Yeah, and able to buy so many things.
I mean, although in some ways that is kind of what Mao intended for himself.
I just like how it was like a full-throated, unironic, you know, defense of communism.
They have a very different understanding of what communism means.
We can afford Gucci, therefore Chinese communism has won.
It's the best communism. Communism has finally, true communism has finally been tried.
And obviously the communism with Chinese characteristics is the best.
Well, obviously, it's got Chinese characteristics.
Well, I do have to say that this kind of reminded me of, and you guys have probably seen this image that was floating around, the image of the internet, where it's a photograph of the Gucci store in Beijing, and there's like a digital billboard on top of the store that just has the hammer and sickle repeated over and over and over again. So Gucci, hammer and sickle across the whole thing.
What do things even mean anymore? What do words mean? They mean nothing.
I don't know. It's just, it's actually, there's been, I feel like, a lot of joy and hilarity brought to us by the kind of pro-CC people lately coming out and, you know, supporting the Chinese regime at these protests that are against the Hong Kong protesters. Mm-hmm. In different places around the world. Have you guys seen some of these videos?
Yes, I've seen all of the ones that you're going to talk about, but go ahead and describe them.
Oh, well, yeah, this is what happens when we try to describe videos on a podcast. But I think we showed on one of our episodes one of the ones with a guy with the Ferrari with the Chinese flag driving around.
Mm-hmm.
There was another one.
Another example of Chinese communism in action.
Yeah, well, there was another one where this guy pulls up in his Ferrari to a handicapped parking space.
Ooh.
Parks there and starts blasting March of the Volunteers, the Chinese national anthem, through his speakers. And then you can hear the cheering from the people around. But it's just like this perfect. And then the guy sitting in the passenger side is smoking a joint.
It really is perfect.
Yeah.
And weren't you also telling me about another incident that got some policemen laughing?
Oh, yes. I don't remember where this was, but there's a group of Hong Kong protesters chanting "Free Hong Kong." And then across the street, a group of the, you know, China flag waving protesters, they get mad that the people are chanting "Free Hong Kong," so they start chanting "Free China." And then the policemen start laughing.
Chinese communism.
It's, you know, it's winning. Winning hearts and minds.
That seems to be true.
Oh, there was another one that was pretty great, which was this older Chinese man in L.A. yelling. Because some people were kind of making the point that if, you know, some of these protesters, they love China so much, why are they in Australia or Canada or the U.S.? Like, why don't they go back to China? So I gather that there was some kind of exchange like this between the different groups of protesters, and this Chinese guy starts yelling about how he doesn't have to go back to China. This is Genghis Khan's country. So this is China. So he's going to stay here.
What?
He's in L.A. I don't know.
It's Genghis. L.A. is Genghis Khan? That makes so much sense. No wonder it's a wasteland.
You can say that because you're from L.A.
And I love L.A. And I love New York. And I love Chinese people and Chinese communism. And especially the Ferrari that I hope they'll send me.
Oh, what if they only give you a Lamborghini?
Then screw it, I'm throwing it on the ground. All right.
That would still be impressive.
Picking up a Lamborghini and throwing it on the ground?
Yes.
I mean, not if it's, like, this big.
Shelley just gestured, like, no more than 6 inches. I don't know why they would make a small Lamborghini. That's a toy Lamborghini.
Toy cars?
Made out of Legos.
You guys didn't have toy cars as kids?
Well, in this scenario, I was imagining that they would send me an actual Lamborghini.
Mm.
Anyways, this is getting off the rails very quickly. So let's go into the interview segment and actually talk to somebody who has something interesting to say. Not that that wasn't interesting, Shelley. I was just kind of, God, I'm in over my head. Okay. Joining us tonight are Joyce Eugene Lee and Dan Pfeiffer. Joyce is a visual artist working with video, digital photography, and interactive installation. Her artwork examines how mass media and culture shapes notions of truth and understanding of the other. She is an assistant professor of art and digital media at Marist College in New York and loves traveling to China for art research. Dan is a software developer who works at the ACLU. This semester, he is teaching a course on hacktivism at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. So thank you for joining us.
Our pleasure. Yeah.
I'm glad you both jumped in on that together to express your joy. So we first met at the Oslo Freedom Forum, where we got to see the Firewall Cafe in action. So tell the audience what that is.
So Firewall Cafe is a way for audiences to simulate plausibly what it's like to be behind the Great Firewall. And this is a technological barrier that censors much of the internet. And I'm sure your audience is very familiar with the Great Firewall. But a lot of the people who interact with the project maybe have heard of it, but don't experience what that's like firsthand, especially American audiences.
Mm-hmm. And the reality of it is very different than just like, oh, there's some kind of censorship thing in China.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a way for people to try out searches, and we use Google image search and compare the results to Baidu image search results. So even if you're monolingual like I am, there's still some capacity to see a comparison between the two results.
And Baidu is basically the Chinese version of Google.
Yeah, the software is shockingly similar. The image search results look very similar, except for the, you know, the content is very different.
Mm-hmm.
So when it simulates what it's like to be behind the Great Firewall, somebody's standing over you pretending to be a Chinese policeman and beating you while you try and do your search.
That's Joyce.
That would be funny. Actually, not funny. That would be scary, but... No, actually, you still can find results for things that you're searching, but oftentimes the things that might be deemed sensitive by state authorities produce kind of unrelated or nonsensical results. And so sometimes you will find exactly what you're looking for, and then sometimes you get steered in a totally different direction.
So the way it's set up, like if I were to go interact with the Firewall Cafe, what would I see?
So the physical installation, it's the original iteration of the project was in Chinatown in Manhattan, and it was set up kind of like an internet cafe, and there was even a place where you could get tea, and you know, had the trappings of a space that you might want to spend some time in. And each computer has two screens, and so you see on one screen Google search engine, and on the other one you see Baidu search engine. And if you type something in, the first thing you'll notice is the recommended terms. If you're typing on the Google side, we replace the Google recommendations with like a list of known sensitive terms, just to kind of entice people to try out some that we know to be sensitive. And then what happens next is like this this sort of machine translation takes place using some software, and seemingly magically, assuming you typed in an English search phrase, a Mandarin, a Chinese equivalent will appear in Baidu, and it will show search results on that side.
So what's an example, Dan, of a search term that gets radically different results when searching in Google versus Baidu?
I mean, it seems like the most popular search term has to do with the Tiananmen Square massacre. At least for audiences who aren't too familiar with the nuances of contemporary politics in China. So we have a lot of results for that one. And obviously, you're not going to see a lot of the, you know, the graphic imagery that Google depicts. Although Google has its own, it's worth mentioning that Google does its own form of censorship in the safe search feature that's on by default.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to note that, you know, there's it's not like the Google site is uncensored. It's just it has a different set of censorship instructions guiding it.
Well, we could do a whole thing about the censorship of Google, but at least as of compared to China's Baidu, let's focus on that. So yeah, so say you do a search for Tiananmen, what comes up on the Baidu?
On the Baidu side, you'll see mostly tourist pictures of what the site looks like if you were to visit just for fun, as it looks today, versus anything historical that might have happened there. That's
may or may not have happened.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what about something like the Dalai Lama? That's another big issue.
Yeah, that one, let me actually pull it up. I mean, one of the nice things about how this project operates is we can actually look to see on the website what searches for the Dalai Lama exist.
This is real time?
It's not real time, yeah. So these are archived from the in-person events that we've set up. So what it shows is the accumulated searches of people who saw the art installation and interacted with it.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't worked out how to do this like as a live website that you can search yet, but it's something we've talked a lot about.
Yeah, Dan and I could come install it on your computer, and then you could do live searches anytime you want.
Oh.
But as of now, we don't have a virtual version to offer.
I see. Well, that would be cool.
Yeah, and I don't know what would come up for Dalai Lama because I don't have the archive in front of me, but my guess is Baidu probably has some results, but if there are images depicted of the Dalai Lama, perhaps he would be shown in a negative light, like with a grumpy face on or maybe angry and looking not Dalai Lama-like is my guess.
Or maybe drawn as a wolf in monk's clothes.
Yes, actually, and cartoons and characters are one of the things that we often see when it's known that Baidu is censoring something. Chinese people have this clever way of, instead of using photographs, then using political cartoons or other types of illustration, because those are harder for the censorship bots to comb out and to weed out.
Also, in doing the Firewall Cafe, you've kind of discovered ways in which Chinese netizens work around the censorship.
Oh,
that's
absolutely
really interesting. What are some other ways that they kind of deal with this?
Certainly there's certain placeholders for phrases that are known to be censored. Like, I don't know, Joyce, you probably have some that you can come. None of them are coming to mind, but there's a ton of like synonyms that, you know, people have worked out as a way to cleverly avoid the censorship. But of course, then it seems like the firewall catches up and it catches those, and so new ones are used to avoid censorship.
Constant right. evolution.
Like May exactly. 35th, May 35th for June 4th.
Or I'm thinking exactly. River Crab for
Harmonize,
because it's the same.
Yes.
It's a synonym.
Exactly.
So how did the idea for this come up?
This was a harebrained idea that I came up with after a trip to Beijing in 2011. I was working for a curator there named James Elaine, who is a really talented curator that works on finding emerging artists in China. And we were bringing a group of North American artists, about a dozen or so, to China on a cultural exchange artist residency. And that summer, I was the residency coordinator, so I had to distribute VPNs to all the people who were on our trip. And so that summer, we got to see and experience, you know, what the internet is like without a VPN in China, and then what it's like with the VPN, and kind of the things that happen that tend to jam up your VPN or make it not work. And it's hard to quantify all that with exactitude, but I remember thinking like, oh, that's weird. If I typed in something like, where is the nearest church to where I am right now, that suddenly my VPN would stop working and I would have to restart it and try again. And then after that initial fail, it wouldn't work as well. I can't say that with any type of scientific accuracy, but I started to become curious about how internet censorship works. And so when I came back to the US, there was a sequence of some personal events that happened with the community that I was with in China. A young artist took his own life. And it just made me think about, you know, his day-to-day experience in China. What was it like being a young gay artist whose family doesn't accept his lifestyle? You know, how he might use the internet as a way to access communities that he can't meet in person on the ground in China, and how his perceptions could be completely distorted based on the censorship in the country that he lives in. So I just thought, is there a way I could show people what this experience might feel like, even though we're not in China? And so I, through a friend of a friend, met Dan and figured out that perhaps there is a way to make this happen from a coding standpoint. And in 2016, we launched this crazy project thanks to some generous funding from various grants around New York City.
CIA Black Hands.
Actually, it was the Franklin Furnace Fund, which is a wonderful organization that supports art that they consider as vulnerable. Also, the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council in New York and the Asian Women Giving Circle.
Sounds like CIA fronts. So what were your goals with this project? I mean, yes, to kind of give people an idea of what it's like in there, but...
Right. The initial goal was to just help people experience firsthand, because most people probably who have never heard of the Great Firewall would probably also not have the opportunity to travel there and experience it firsthand. So that was kind of the immediate goal. But kind of the longer term and bigger picture goal was to help develop some sort of empathy for people who live in places where there is no free internet, and to in some small way chip at the problem of internet freedom worldwide. So at the time, I hadn't heard of the term hacktivism, but I feel like that was the spirit with which I thought about making the project.
I love going to the Oslo Freedom Forum. I learn such great new terms. I learn hacktivism. I learn laughtivism.
All the different activisms.
Yeah, I wonder what the next one will be. I hope eat a steakivism.
Okay.
Better than nuketivism.
I kind of like the sound of that.
So I'm in the process of assembling my syllabus to talk to some young impressionable undergrads about hacktivism, and
I'm teaching the course, and
I'm thinking about how to get a little distance on the idea of using software and technology to put change out into the world, and thinking a lot about how you can pivot from a hacktivist practice to something that's more like digital organizing, where you have a little more of a long-term like purpose and mission in mind. And I haven't, I don't know if I've worked out like what that looks like for this project or even my other like hacktivist interests. But to me, that feels like, I mean, I feel like hacktivism is a bit limiting in the same way that I think I turn to the word organizing more nowadays than activist as as an identity.
Actually, Dan, I think those are really important questions to think about, because as activists, I mean, at least in my direct experience, I'm not sure, I think I've heard this echoed with a lot of the people at the Oslo Freedom Forum. It's like, how can you actually bring about change? You know, awareness is one thing, but how do you get people so engaged in an issue that they want to do something about it? So I think that's important that you're asking that question. And that's something that we've talked a little bit about, like how to make Firewall something sustainable that can have a longer term impact, that can be applied towards all different, you know, people groups. So I'm in the process of working that out this year with Firewall.
I could see that being a difficult question, since you've decided to take on the biggest censorship.
But there's lots of opportunity there. So are you thinking?
There is, yeah.
Are you thinking things like creating, like a social media platform that allows like dissidents to be able to share information in a way that's like encrypted, or a stronger VPN, some kind of digital cash transfer that's not traceable, stuff like that?
Ooh.
Yeah, I don't know. Those are all great ideas.
Yeah. You have to repeat those for me after the call. I'm going to write them.
Yeah.
I've got a great idea for your next art installation. So instead of it being about the firewall, it's about the Uyghurs, and you try to recreate this experience. So you bring, you know, visitors into a room. You beat them. Strip search them, check everything on their phones, and you put them into concentration camps and then send their kids off to other concentration camps.
Sounds like JFK. Am I right? Boy, airport security.
Yeah.
I would say LaGuardia, but yeah.
Yeah, the situation going on with the Uyghurs actually is like one of the prime examples of ways that I would like to see Firewall applied. So instead of just, you know, kind of welcoming participants to do random searches, which oftentimes is interesting because we see the same things repeated over time. So, you know, we can track the same search for Tiananmen Square from 2016 in New York to 2019 in Hong Kong, right? But I think with specific current events going on, if we can come up with ways where Firewall can do more targeted searches to search really, really deep as opposed to very, very broad. And if we have that kind of data collected from different locations, we might find some interesting ways that, you know, these current events are being manipulated in the news or online.
Well, I'm curious, you mentioned that like tracking from a search in New York and then a search in Hong Kong years later. What have you noticed a difference in that kind of search?
I don't know. I mean, I can't say off the top of my head, like, what types of things might have changed. I'm not even sure. So there's a detail that I should have mentioned in my description, which is that we have a way of VPNing the internet connection of, say, New York City behind the Great Firewall. So you have, like, an internet connection that to Baidu, it looks like you're requesting it from, you know, a site in China, in mainland China.
This is like a reverse VPN.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing the reverse of what everyone else is trying to do most of the time. And, you know, I'm not... So you can also access Baidu without that reverse VPN. It's not like they restrict access to the website. And I have not been able to say with any certainty if that technique makes any difference.
I feel like it must. And I'm just going to use this as an example. Like when I was in Shanghai just last week, they were a colleague was trying to show me their new like Amazon equivalent, which is this crazy shopping site called Tmall or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Are y'all familiar with
yep.
it? Uh-huh. And I forgot that I was running a VPN on my phone. And so I loaded Tmall on my phone. And of course, my colleague, who's, you know, not running one because he's in China on his phone, he loaded it on his phone. And the results were completely different, but it was the same site. So I do think that perhaps like the different versions of a site catered for an international audience could be at play here with Baidu. Just a thought.
It could be. Yeah. I don't have any evidence yet. And I, mm-hmm. you know, we've been doing this project for a while and we have a lot of images to compare. And I don't know. I'm still uncertain. And I think that's part of the frustration of the way this censorship operates is we'll have, you know, we've gone through a lot of different methods for simulating our connection mm-hmm. and different ones will fail kind of mysteriously or go really slow after a certain search term goes through. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly like something happening, but you never, you know, there's not like a pop-up window that's like, your search has been censored.
Right.
Although yeah. there are a couple terms that you see like in the top of the page, like the there are no search results for this. And it's because I forget what the exact phrasing is, but
like internet regulations. Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. I mean, only sometimes though.
Right. You know, you just gave me an idea. Perhaps one of the things we could do is have like a hacking session where people all are in various locations around the world are all running firewall at the same time. And then we can see if Baidu looks different in all these different places and if they get the same search. Because I'm sure Baidu also has the same kind of customization and machine learning that happens with Google, where it becomes customized based on what you search. I don't know that for a fact, but I would think that that could also influence what you see or don't see.
I do have to say, though, that I've heard many, many complaints from people about Baidu, just in general, as a search engine. So you're also probably dealing a little bit with that as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what has been some of the responses to the Firewall Cafe?
Well, there have been many. Most people are just kind of enamored, I guess, with the novelty of...
kind of missing the point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think they're missing the point, but I think they're just so enamored with the fact that they can search in two different countries at the same time. So that's usually our kind of like what I've heard is the first response. But in Hong Kong, I think when we popped up in January, that was perhaps the most engaged community that I've seen interact with Firewall. And it was great to see, you know, people, especially of the older generation, cluster around and start going through their Rolodex of activist figures in their head or politically controversial, you know, people that in local Hong Kong politics, and see how that, you know, like people who are really affected by censorship or any kind of political corruption have like a running list of things that they want to see and want to see played out through our project. So that's, for me, been the most inspiring because, you know, with Hong Kongers, the project really hit a nerve, but in a good way.
They were searching very different things then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Really specific to what's going on right now. Although when we were there in January, I think everybody was in agreement that the situation was grim, but you know, the protests hadn't started then. And so when I was there in January, people were kind of in a slump. Mm-hmm. They were feeling very demoralized, like the Umbrella Movement really had putzed out and things weren't going to change. And it was only a matter of time, like the art space that I showed in. Center for Community Cultural Development. They have two locations and it's actually run by the government, but we were in the Green Wave art space and that space was being shut down by the local government, even though it's their own nonprofit space. And, you know, all the people who are running the space know it's due to pressures from Chinese authorities because they've done a lot of performance protests and art projects speaking out against the government. But they were going to be closed due to being slapped a retail fine on a nonprofit space. And they conceded to not even try to argue with it or change that situation. And, you know, I had a donor who was willing to give money right then and there to keep the space open. And the local people said, you know, we can't accept this money because if we do, that means all the other people in Hong Kong who are trying to take a stand will have to follow suit in order to proceed. And so we have to stand in solidarity and just let this get shut down. And we will fight and find another way to open up. But looking at the, you know, protests that are going on now, it's completely different. And that was just 7 months ago. And so it's been interesting to see that change so quickly. Yeah. You know, obviously, Hong Kongers feel really different now.
Oh, yeah. That sounds kind of, even back in 2016, the last time we were there before this year, it was, like you said, it was just completely demoralized mm-hmm. in terms of the protest movement and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it changed quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe the Firewall Cafe gave some of the older generation a little more of a taste of what life will be like under more mainland control. And maybe you primed them for the protests.
Oh, that would be cool to think about. Yeah. I know the young people, we collaborated with some anonymous artists there who were coming from the mainland. And originally the idea, yeah, it was cool. The original idea was just to have Firewall be a solo show. But, you know, I was asking them, like, I really want to engage the local audience. So the curator had this idea that we could schedule some performances around the duration of the time that Firewall would be popping up. And so a troupe of about 6 to 8 anonymous performers came from the southern provinces of China, and they wrote this amazing interactive play about internet censorship, where each of the characters embodied an internet entity in China. So, for example, Weixing, Weibo, you know, Taobao, all these different
interesting. Kind of,
yeah, online identities. And then they invited the audience to vote on how they should respond to the internet regulations that were passed in 2016. And they had this kind of interactive play where they would like perform a few skits, then the audience would vote on what would happen next. And it was this really dark, almost sadistic play where the characters were kind of beating each other up, they were wrestling. And, you know, it was really great to hear them say that, you know, because Firewall was showing in Hong Kong, they then had the opportunity and a window to create work about internet censorship and show it in a way that they would never be able to do in the mainland. And that was really exciting for me. They were very young artists, like fresh out of grad school.
Oh, that sounds incredible.
That is mm-hmm. also a very brave thing to do, even yeah. anonymously in Hong Kong.
Yeah, they definitely were very anxious, and they weren't willing to talk to the reporter from Hong Kong Free Press. But, you know, the local young people came out, and there was a consistent turnout for every performance. I think there were 4 total, and people stayed for hours afterwards to discuss, you know, the state of the internet and censorship in their lives.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so then this kind of begs the question, what has been the CCP's response to the Firewall Cafe?
Oh, yeah. They intervened in our very first exhibition in New York.
Oh, intervene how?
Oh, boy. Well, so Dan, feel free to chime in at any point.
No, you're the best person to tell the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we were very lucky that before our exhibition opened, there was a nonprofit portion of Google called uProxy that heard about our project, and they agreed to partner with us to help us kind of figure out some of the technical aspects of connecting to the internet in China. And so we had at our disposal this wonderful team of engineers that, you know, Dan kind of worked with to design the kind of behind the screen, so to speak. And then we worked with an organization called Great Fire That's an anonymous hacktivist organization focused on internet censorship in China. And I don't know where kind of the leak happened along the line. We have a couple of guesses, but we opened the show and had a sequence of public events around the exhibition, which opened on the anniversary of the arrest of the Feminist Five in Beijing. And one of those panels was a panel about tech and feminism in China. And so we had a wonderful panel, including your friend, Dan, Susan McGregor, is that her last name?
Yeah.
From the Dow Digital Center of Journalism at Columbia, Sitoa Mingming, some La La filmmakers from Beijing, who created the first documentary about the women's summit that the UN hosted in 1995 in China, and a bunch of other really wonderful activists and feminists doing important work. Also Lu Ping, who wrote Feminist Voices blog, which has since been shut down by the authorities. And so one of the panelists was a lawyer who is the first lawyer who has successfully won two cases against the government over carried out trials of the single child policy. So there were like some forced abortions that went wrong and things like that. And so she was supposed to be coming down from Yale China Center to speak about her work on women's reproductive rights in China. And the night before the lecture, her law firm back in China received a phone call. And basically the authorities let her law firm know that they need to control their lawyer, that she's not allowed to work with this New York artist. And we were all very shocked because I'm not famous. And from my understanding, I don't think she is, or maybe she was, but we decided we would proceed anyways, and that we would just make it look like she canceled. So the morning of the panel discussion, she received another phone call that she had to return to China. She was never allowed to speak in public again, and that the fellowship would have to end. And so that became a really everything just became very real. And of course, the last thing I would want to do as an American artist who's trying to bring light to this important issue is to put a Chinese national in harm's way. So she did not come to the lecture. And, we knew that there was a potential something like this could happen, but we were all kind of taken by surprise when it did. And so we had kept an RSVP list and required that everybody RSVP in order to come. But the night of the event, there were people who did not RSVP, who were quite suspect, that had showed up, and they came together, and they were clearly Chinese. Without going into too much detail, I think it was to make sure that the orders were carried out and that this person didn't show up. And so, it was a really tense time for all of us. And we had to consult a lot of more experienced people to figure out the right way to handle the situation. But that person has since stayed in the U.S. Yeah.
Wow. So they basically knew about you guys from the very beginning.
I don't know if they knew about us or they were tracking the human rights work of this lawyer. And just waiting to find an excuse, because that year, actually, there had been a lot of arrests in her province of human rights lawyers. I guess it would have been the summer before. And so our show was opening in the winter. So I think, it might have been some residual from that. I'm not really sure. Our partners also have a bigger reputation than us. So perhaps it was because of that. It's hard to say, but I think for all of us, it was a really big learning experience that art has some power. I never, ever thought that, when I set out to make this project. I just thought, if I can help some people become more aware of the situation, that's like enough for me to feel like I'm doing my job as an artist. But but the impact was greater than we could have anticipated.
Well, you know, if the Chinese Communist Party really wanted to mess with you guys, they could uncensor their internet. So then, like, that just completely ruins your whole thing.
I had considered that. You're right. The project would be gone.
Don't do that. Yeah.
Loving all these new ideas that we're collecting.
I know.
I'm full of them. So what's next?
Well, we have our next pop-up scheduled September at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, September 19th through the 22nd. And we're going to pop up Firewall at the New Media Caucus Symposium. This year's theme is border control. And so we're excited to pop up there with really informed artists who work with the internet and who focus on border control issues. And I'm working with a developer on the West Coast, Peter Baer, who is helping us come up with a relaunch of Firewall that will have improved ways of filtering our archive of search results from 2016 till now that have been collected across New York, Oslo, Norway, St. Poulton, Austria, Hong Kong, and now Michigan. And people will be able to navigate our website with a lot more clarity. And after this web relaunch, we're hoping to work with some people who specialize in data and image analysis so that we can come up with a way for us to kind of find threads and trends with the search results that we've collected over these last 3 years.
Great. And if somebody wanted to know more about you guys or the Great Firewall itself, where should they go?
Firewallcafe.com is our website.
Yes.
Cool. Well, great. Thank you guys so much for joining us. That was fantastic stories you shared.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for inviting us to talk with y'all.
And just a reminder to everyone, we are drinking Path of Cha tea. If you would like to get your own, use the link we put in the description below. You'll be helping out the show. And order some Lushan Yunwu Clouds and Mist green tea.
For people who can't see the description because they're not watching it on YouTube, what is the link?
So if you're listening on iTunes and can't see the descriptions, that link is pathofcha.com/?ref=China_unscripted. Get some great tea and help the show out. And once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And we'll see you for tea next time.